Chapter 3, The World Begins to Open. Junior high school was a big transition for me. I went from a small school to this junior high school, which had about 1,500 students in three grades, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. It was not just a change in size, but it was an open campus, almost like a high school. You could come and go during lunch, for example. Instead of being with one teacher the whole time, you went from class to class, like in high school. Testing. And then there's this whole thing, at least in the 50s, and from what I know it still goes on, when you're a guy and a new kid, you're almost forced to fight your way through some situations. I don't want to exaggerate, because it wasn't anything like being in jail in an overall sense, but in this particular dimension, it's almost a modified form of going to jail. You're new, and people are going to test you out. I remember when I first got to junior high, older guys would pick on you, and you'd have to stand up for yourself. So you got in fights. And even people who used to be your friends would pick fights with you to prove themselves to their new friends. Earlier I mentioned Ray, who was a very close friend of mine during most of my grammar school years. He lived down the street, and we used to spend a lot of time at each other's houses. Then his mom had a stroke when he was still in grammar school, and while she didn't die, she also never recovered from it. So his life became very, very difficult. And I think that's maybe why this stray dog he found was so important to him. But when we went to junior high school, at one point I ended up getting in a fight with him because we kind of went into different worlds and he was in a crowd that didn't like the crowd that I was in. That kind of stuff. It was just a whole bigger world and you had to deal with a whole new set of conflicts and contradictions that you didn't have to deal with in the grammar school that I went to in the Berkeley Hills. At the junior high I went to a large degree, there were the same kind of people from the same strata and groups in society as at my grammar school. Out of 1,500 kids at that junior high, there were maybe 25 or 30 black kids, maybe an equal number of Chicanos, and maybe a few Asians. It was still overwhelmingly white, although some of the kids were from more working-class families. One of the black kids in my class became my best friend at one point, but that didn't happen until 9th grade. Yet overall, it was a different dynamic. You were swimming in a much bigger pool, and it felt like there were more dangerous fish in the water. So it wasn't quite so innocent or so safe, even though things weren't as raw as in the other junior highs in the city. It was a big change, and there was a lot of social pressure to start acting like a man, to prove you're tough. For example, I spent 8th grade carrying a switchblade knife around with me. Fortunately, I never really had to do anything with it, because I really didn't know what to do with it exactly, and really I didn't want to do anything with it. But I carried it around, and I suppose I could have gotten into a situation where the logic of it could have taken over, and I would have been forced to do something terrible or have something terrible done to me. There was a lot of posturing, and that was what you were expected to do in a certain way. It was almost like a ritual, a rite of passage that you were going through to prove that you were tough, that you could handle yourself. You developed a certain swagger. You know, you tried to convey a certain image of yourself. Inside, you were very conflicted and not all that happy about it. It was a difficult time. I felt alienated from things, but I couldn't quite exactly say why, even to myself. It wasn't all negative. I did make a lot of new friends, but I was still going through a lot of changes at that time. I never really got in any really serious trouble. I had a few brushes with the police, but nothing serious. The social stratum that I came from meant that I didn't get in the same kind of trouble as somebody else would have. But I had a lot of run-ins and friction with teachers and other school authorities. I had a certain kind of posture, and a lot of the parents didn't like the influence I was having on their kids, or that they imagined I would have on their kids. Sometimes these parents didn't know what their own kids were into, or if they did, they wanted to blame somebody other than their own kids or themselves. Anyway, the word would get around. I don't know how the grapevine of the parents worked, but they knew about me. I was not into big trouble, but always on the border of big trouble, always on the brink of getting into something bad. So a lot of parents didn't want their kids hanging around me. And when my 13th birthday came, nobody came for my party or anything. I was all by myself on my birthday, which of course was very upsetting to me. Tournament of Champions. But one good thing that came out of that was when my father said, "You know, there's this high school basketball tournament going on at Cal, the Tournament of Champions. Why don't you go down there? Since you don't have anything to do, maybe you'll have a good time with that. So he gave me a ride and dropped me off. And this was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen. All these high school teams were playing one game after the other, and the place was crammed with high school students from all these different schools, along with a lot of other people. I had missed a great game the night before, where El Cerrito beat McClymans by 1 point at the buzzer. McClymans was a school in West Oakland that always had these great teams. A little later, they won 68 games in a row, and they won this tournament of champions something like 6 years in a row. I'd missed that game with El Cerrito, but then I came in next night, and there was McClymans playing for third place in the tournament, and they had all these players on their team that I still remember. They had Cleveland Pete McKinney, who could really shoot the ball outside, and considered himself open for a shot as soon as he crossed half court. Pete McKinney had a younger brother, Charles Cha-Cha McKinney, who was a star player for McClymans a couple of years later and kind of a legend around the playgrounds. I was thrilled when, during my high school years, Cha-Cha came over to Live Oak Park, and I ended up playing on his squad quite a few times in pickup games. Another legendary player for McClymans that year was Joe Gardier, who was only about 5'9", but was a tremendous leaper. He could just jump out of the gym. And all these schools would bring their rooting sections to the Tournament of Champions. So all of a sudden, here you had a whole lot of students from McClymans in the Cal gym. There would also be these all-white schools from the suburbs. There would be Catholic schools, which were almost all-white at that time. And then there would be schools like Richmond High, which was a real proletarian high school. When I was going to Berkeley High, they used to jokingly say that even the white kids are tough at Richmond High. Later, when I was in high school, we were in the same athletic league with Richmond High. And over the years, if Berkeley High didn't make it to the Tournament of Champions, Richmond High usually did. But that first year I went to the TOC was a completely new and different experience for me. After that, as long as I lived in the Bay Area, I was sure to be at the Tournament of Champions. And after moving away from the Bay Area in the early 1970s, I would try to get back to see the TOC whenever I could. It was a 3-day tournament, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, early in March every year. And the first game used to start at 4:30 on Thursday. I would always be one of the first 3 or 4 people to be there when they opened the doors for the 4:30 game, and I'd always stay until the very end every night. This was just a wonderful thing, not just the athletics, but the whole social experience. Going to the TOC completely turned things around for me on my 13th birthday and became an important part of my life from then on. Cutting up. I had all kinds of friction with my parents in 8th grade. Usually I got good grades, and while I might cut up in class and be kind of a prankster and cause all kinds of chaos, I didn't get in big trouble with the police or with the school authorities. So that would generally keep my parents feeling good about me. But in 8th grade, I was going through all these changes, and for a good part of one semester in particular, I let my grades go. I had this one English teacher, and we just clashed all the time. I was cutting up in class, and she was new to teaching. She didn't even dislike me. In fact, she met with my parents several times and said, "Look, I really like him, but I just can't teach with him in my class." I'll give this teacher credit for not being completely uptight. For example, we were reading a Dickens novel, I believe it was Tale of Two Cities, and I fell way behind. At one point she gave us a test, and as part of it we had to identify a character named Prior Edwards. I didn't know who Prior Edwards was, so I gave as an answer, "So named because he had the habit of always being early." This was a 4-point question, and she gave me 2 points for creativity. Early on, I got from my father in particular this propensity for telling puns and doing wordplay. And to some people's great dismay, I've continued this throughout my life. This 8th grade teacher was also the victim of this very unusual froggy type voice I had developed. Whenever she would turn her back on the class and say, "Now who knows what happens at this point in the book?" I'd go into my voice and say, "Nobody does." That kind of stuff and other things I did would really disrupt her class. She tried everything. She kept me after class, so I'd have detention after detention. And I wanted to be on the playground or off with my friends. Finally, I wrote this manifesto, some 5- or 6-page thing, declaring this dictatorial system of detention and the teacher's word being law to be totally unjust. I showed it to a bunch of my friends, including the ones who were in detention with me, and they all said, "Great! This is like our Declaration of Independence. Let's go present this to the teacher or the principal." But somehow it never happened. It kind of faded away. Like I said, she wasn't really a bad person, but she was new to teaching, and I was going through this difficult period, so we just locked horns all the time. And that started getting me into real conflict with my parents. She would keep me in detention, but that wouldn't stop me, so she called in my parents, and they were at their wits' end. Finally, they got me to behave, or sort of pull in my horns and get through this semester, because of a track meet coming up. My dad had taken me to my first track meet at Cal earlier that year, 1956. On the Cal track team was this great black sprinter named Lehman King, who had this beautiful running style, which I really just fell in love with. He was running in the Olympic trials, which were being held at Cal. My parents told me that if they didn't get a seal of approval from this teacher, saying that I was straightening out in class, they would not let me go to these Olympic trials. I had my heart set on this, so I agonized, literally spending sleepless nights over whether it was worth it to keep cutting up in class, and I finally decided, okay, I'll make a tactical retreat. I started studying more, and I got my grades back up, and my parents backed off a bit, because at least in the outward manifestation of these things, I smoothed out the rough edges. Arbitrary authority. Even though I did this whole traffic boy thing in grammar school, I had also at a very early age internalized the idea that arbitrary authority wasn't deserving of respect. I had gotten from my parents a strong sense that you should not have to follow people who required unthinking obedience, the drill sergeant or the military dictator being the embodiment of that. I don't know if they ever articulated exactly that way, but that was sort of a general value or outlook that I got. I remember we had this math teacher in junior high who kept three of us after class one time because we were joking around in class. He started reading us the riot act, and one of the kids started laughing out of nervousness. The teacher yelled, "You think that's funny?" He grabbed the kid by the throat and started choking him and almost pushed him out the second-story window. So that kind of arbitrary dictatorial authority was something that I hated from early on. It was against everything that I thought was worth anything and should be respected. I had also internalized from my parents, and from my father in particular, that the Constitution provided you with certain rights, and you should stand up for them. If people tried to take away your rights, you should resist that. So in my own mind, with a lot of these teachers, that's what I was doing. They were exercising arbitrary authority, insisting on their way in the classroom, and not willing to be flexible or to bend. That's overwhelmingly the way the teachers taught in the 50s, so I had a lot of conflict with them. But one time when I was 13, I applied what I'd learned from my dad and got in big trouble with my parents for doing so. I'd been down at the park and I was coming home, riding my bike. I took a shortcut that ran by my old grammar school. It wasn't actually on the school property. It was a public sidewalk or a kind of paved path between two streets right next to the school. A couple of my friends were hanging around my old grammar school, so I stopped and started messing around with them. One of the things we liked to do was to climb up on the roof of the cafeteria of the grammar school. But we knew that you weren't supposed to do that, that you'd get chased off of it. So we took our shoes off and threw them up on the roof, and then climbed up, ostensibly to retrieve our shoes. It was about 5 o'clock, and the only person there was the janitor. Understandably, as I look back on it now, he was freaked out that we were up on the roof. First of all, we could get hurt, and second, he could be held liable. So he's yelling at us to get off the roof, and we're saying we have to get our shoes because somebody threw our shoes up here. But he kept insisting we come down. The more he insisted that we come down, the more we refused to come down. Finally, he said, "I'm going to call the police if you don't come down right away." And at that point, we did come down off the roof. Well, he had called the cops, and a cop showed up. By that time, my friends had split, but I had decided to stand my ground. I was standing on this pathway, which was adjacent to the school grounds, but was not technically school property. So the cop comes and he starts giving me all his trouble. He says, "You know you can't be up on the roof." And I answered, "Well, I got down off the roof. I had to go get my shoes, but I got down off the roof." Then he noticed that I didn't have my shoes on, and he said, "What's the matter with you? You don't even wear shoes?" And he started insulting me and then told me to go home. But I said, "You can't tell me to go home. You can tell me to get off the school property, but you can't tell me to go home. This is public property. I can do what I want. You can't make me go home." He argued with me a while longer and then got in his car and took off. At that point, I started riding my bike home. I was about halfway home when I see my dad driving down toward me. And he sees me and pulls over. I get off my bike and I go running up to the car and I say, "Dad, Dad, a cop can't make me go home if I'm on public property. He can't tell me what to do, can he?" "You better get on your bike and go home," said my dad. So then I knew I was in big shit. I go home and we go through the whole story and I'm insisting, "Okay, I shouldn't have been on the roof, but I got off the roof and I was on public property and I was standing up for my rights and this cop had no right to tell me to go home." And then it turned out that the worst part of this is that what really bothered my parents was that they were embarrassed in front of all the neighbors in their nice, neat, middle-class neighborhood. A policeman had come to their door to tell them their son was doing something wrong. And all the neighbors must have figured out that something like that was happening. Here was my dad, with his stature as a lawyer, having a policeman come to his door to tell him his son was doing something wrong. On top of that, this cop tells him, "Well, you know, we're used to getting this kind of attitude from kids in West Berkeley, in other words, in the ghetto, but we're not used to seeing that from kids around here." Instead of standing up for me, my parents were embarrassed and actually coerced me into writing a letter of apology to this cop. I held out and held out, but it was going to be hell for me in the house if I didn't. So they finally made me write this letter of apology. And here what I was doing was standing up. At that point, I frankly had pride in being associated with kids from West Berkeley, because I felt that they must know how to stand up for their rights then. I felt like I was being cast into good company. But at the time, my parents were just horrified. That really made me feel terrible and lowered them in my estimation, because I felt like, what hypocrites! They taught me all this stuff. How did I know to stand up for my rights? How did I know to tell this cop that I had a constitutional right to go where I wanted, and he could tell me not to be on school property, but he couldn't tell me I had to go home when I was on public property? I knew that from my parents, and in particular my dad, all the legal training that I'd gotten, just by listening to him tell stories, but also talking with him about the Constitution and everything. And here they were turning on me when I stood up for this. So that was kind of a traumatic experience. On the other hand, it was an experience that stood me in good stead for the rest of my life, really. As I said, for a while, this really dropped my parents in my estimation. But I will give them credit that later on, they recognized they were wrong and criticized themselves. My dad, with great chagrin, but also with a certain amount of pride in having learned better, would always tell this story from the point of view of how screwed up he was in taking this position. It was years before they finally recognized that I was right and they were wrong. But they did finally recognize it. Live Oak Park. Around this time, I also started going to this park in Berkeley called Live Oak Park. They had built a new rec center just a little while before I started hanging out there. And a debate had come up as to whether they were going to build indoor basketball courts at the rec center. They already had outdoor courts. My dad told me that the people around there were afraid that if they built an indoor gym, it would attract a lot of black people from the ghettos of the city and from Oakland. And they didn't want that, so they didn't build a new gym. Nonetheless, kids from other parts of Berkeley started coming, and black kids who went to El Cerrito High School, which was between Berkeley and Richmond, started coming over there to Live Oak Park around the time when I was in 8th grade. These kids came to play basketball and hang out on the playground. I'd get out of junior high school around 3 o'clock, and I would go hang out at Live Oak from, say, 3:30 until my parents came and found me, or I got hungry and went home. Later in the spring and summer, when it would be light in the evening, I'd go back and hang out in the evening. So I was starting to have a lot of new experiences and different influences on me, and I was starting to develop different interests, too. By that time, basketball was my favorite sport. I played it all the time. Even later, when I played on the football team in high school, I still played basketball on the weekends, and I played it all year round. Partly, I loved the game itself. But it was also the social atmosphere of hanging around the playground, playing ball and then bullshitting with people who were there. Live Oak Park was still mainly white, but it was changing. They started summer basketball leagues and Bill Russell, when he was a big basketball star at the University of San Francisco, played there. Teams formed up from McClyman's, Richmond, and these other schools and would come over and play in the summer leagues. Big changes were beginning to happen. And of course, there was a lot of tension. I remember one summer, a team from McClyman's was in a summer league at Live Oak, and they were playing shirts and skins. One team wore shirts, and the other team went without shirts. The McClyman's team was skins that night, and they were playing an all-white team. Well, someone, a white guy who I guess was trying not to be insensitive, or maybe he was just out of it, asked, "Which team is the one from McClyman's?" And a guy from McClyman's who was sitting in the stands, his name was Fritz Pointer, and he later played basketball for McClyman's himself, answered, "They're the ones in the brown uppers." For a brief moment, nobody said anything. Then, kind of cautiously, people acknowledged the joke with a ripple of laughter, and the tension eased. White port and lemon juice. There were a lot of things that were going on like that. My older sister Marjorie, for example, went to the same junior high school I did, 3 years ahead of me. They had a yearbook they put out, and they had all these things like favorite movie, favorite song, favorite food, and so on. The year she graduated from junior high, their favorite song was a rhythm and blues doo-wop number called WPLJ, which stood for White Port and Lemon Juice. It was really improbable for this song to be the favorite song of this kind of a junior high, but that just showed how this culture was beginning to make its way into the larger society. KWBR was the rhythm and blues station in Oakland at that time, and my older sister started telling me when I was 13 or so, "If you want to hear some good music, quit listening to that stuff you're into. Listen to KWBR." And that was a big thing in opening up a whole other world for me. I'd always liked music a lot. My mom played the piano and liked to sing, and she got us all involved in music in one way or another. I played the clarinet from age 9 until I was 14, when it began to take too much time away from other things I wanted to do. I wish that I'd kept going with it and branched out and learned to play the saxophone, but I never did. Nevertheless, I liked listening to music, and I loved singing. All that I got mainly from my mother. As a young kid, I listened to all the corny mainstream music. We used to watch this TV show, The Hit Parade. They had a regular stable of singers who would sing these mainstream white bread type of songs, and they'd count down the hits to number one. I actually enjoyed singing some religious music, and I even went caroling at Christmas a few times when I was a teenager. About the only part of church that I could stand was singing hymns, just because I liked to sing. But now, as I was introduced to R&B, it was like a curtain lifting on a whole new world for me. Some friends of mine and I made this pilgrimage to KWBR. It was just an old warehouse-type building in Oakland. But we'd heard all these disc jockeys on the radio. So to us, it was this magical place. We went down there and walked through the studio and listened to them on the air. And we almost felt as if we were in some holy presence. There was this record store that advertised on KWBR, Reed's Records, on Sacramento Street in Berkeley, which was kind of like the center of the ghetto in Berkeley. I remember getting on the bus one time when I was about 13 or 14 and making another pilgrimage down to Reed's Records to just go in there and buy a 45 of R&B music. A lot of things were just getting turned very sharply upside down for me, and I loved it. There was the basketball, and there was the music. There were all these vocal doo-wop groups who were on the radio and had records out. There were the Heartbeats with James Shep Shepherd singing lead, Pookie Hudson and the Spaniels, Earl Speedo Carroll and the Cadillacs, and on and on. And among the girl groups, I especially remember the Chantels, whose lead singer, Arlene Smith, was only about 13 or 14 at the time, but she could really sing with a lot of power and beauty. Then, of course, there was a proliferation of singing groups in high school. Along with the doo-wop vocal groups, there was the broader genre of music that was generally called rhythm and blues. I used to really like Jimmy Reed, a blues singer who had this very characteristic beat. He played the harmonica as well as the guitar. There were songs like Guided Missiles, which was a reflection of the larger world out there. It was a love song, but it was using this metaphor about how your love is like a guided missile which shot me down. Sometimes there were groups that had just one song that would become really big in the doo-wop R&B circles, and sometimes it crossed over to become a big hit in popular music as a whole, that is, among a white audience. But then you wouldn't hear that much from them again, or they wouldn't have a hit on the same level. And a lot of times white groups would do a watered-down cover of an R&B song, and that would be promoted as the big hit version. But it wasn't just one particular doo-wop group or R&B artist that I liked. It was the whole thing. When I was 13 or 14, Marjorie took me to San Francisco to see Chuck Berry in concert. She told my parents that she was taking me to this concert, but then she dropped me off and snuck out with her boyfriend and came back and picked me up when the concert was over. That was a big deal, seeing Chuck Berry perform live. Once my older sister kind of lifted this veil from me and turned me on to what was playing on KWBR, everything about my tastes in music very radically and dramatically changed. Given what was happening in society, I was sort of ripe for that. It also struck a chord with my own feeling of alienation and my shifting values. In ninth grade, my best friend, John, one of the few black kids in the school, got together with me and another white kid to form a doo-wop group for a talent show. We did a coaster song. What is the secret of your success? Now John, even though he was only 14 or 15, had this very low bass voice. This coaster song was kind of a novelty song. I sang the lead and John came in with that bass part, and this guy Randy, the other white kid, did backup singing on it. But when we got to high school, there was this flowering of singing groups on a whole other level. And I'm sure this was also happening at the other junior highs in the city, which had a large percentage of black students. James Dean generation. As I spoke to earlier, my sister and I had these contradictory relationships, mainly because of the larger societal relations which figured into our family, the way they had to do a lot of things that girls traditionally had to do, and some of the privileges I had being a boy. On the positive side, we were close, an example being Marjorie turning me on to this music. It wasn't just somebody telling me about music, it was more intimate, like she was sharing with me something important that she had discovered. But when she was about 15, my older sister really started butting heads with my parents. As I've looked back on this, I've seen it this way. She was part of the Rebel Without a Cause James Dean generation, kids who were starting to come into conflict with a lot of the very strict social conventions and mores that were being imposed from their parents' generation onto them. Especially as this applied to girls, it was very acute. They were restricted in a lot of ways. A proper girl didn't do this and that. It was very constraining and limiting and suffocating for them. My parents were part of that 1930s depression World War II generation. And while they were very sweet and compassionate and generous people, they were also pretty straight-laced at that point. So Marjorie came into a lot of rebel without a cause conflict with them. Of course, there were causes, there were reasons, but it hadn't really formed itself into a conscious rebellion. It was against certain things, but not very consciously. So it would take a lot of different forms, and some of the things she did were kind of stupid, frankly. Nevertheless, stepping back and looking at it with perspective, you can see the larger thing that was going on, regardless of particular forms it took with her. For example, one time my dad walked into my room when I was about 12 or 13 and said, "You're not smoking, are you?" I wasn't, and I had no interest in smoking, so I said no. And he came back in a gruff way that was unusual for him. "Well, you better not." And he walked out of the room. I couldn't figure out what the hell that was about. It turned out that my older sister was smoking. My parents were down on smoking, but not just because it was unhealthy. The whole thing about cigarettes and cancer was really just being discovered. It was more like it wasn't proper to be smoking, especially if you were a kid, and more especially if you were a girl. This was the grinding of gears of different social forces and generations in conflict, so to speak. So there was a lot of that kind of conflict, and it became pretty acute at that time. That's why Marjorie would do things like volunteer to take me to a concert so she could sneak off and see her boyfriend, because she had to do things like that. She couldn't just tell my parents she was taking the car and going somewhere with her boyfriend. Stepping back to get some perspective on this, I think you can see that it wasn't just a matter of my parents as individuals and my older sister as an individual, but the larger social forces underlying these things. The tectonic plates in society were moving and changing and coming into conflict with each other. Marjorie, my older sister, was caught up in that. The difference between the two of us was kind of like a difference between Rebel Without a Cause and Bob Dylan's The Times They Are a-Changin'. Later on, when I rebelled against my parents, it was a more conscious rejecting of a whole set of social and political ideas that was the negative side of what they believed, their acceptance of a lot of mainstream American values from the prevailing institutions. But with my older sister, it was more inchoate, more formless, more beginning, and it didn't really have a clear-cut stance exactly, except butting up against the constraints and the restraints and the suffocation. Later on, Marjorie was sympathetic to a lot of those social causes and struggles that did arise, at least up to a certain point in a pretty general way. But she got married young, and that put a limit on her activity. Still, what was involved was a kind of generational difference. And when I say generational here, I'm not talking about the general difference all of us kids had with our parents. I'm talking about a very compressed difference, with my sister's age group just 3 years older than me. This difference between her generation and mine gives you a sense of just how rapidly things were changing. The civil rights struggle broke out in the mid-50s, but it really became a big phenomenon and had an impact on the whole country in a sustained way by the late 50s and early 60s. That was more my coming-of-age time, whereas my older sister was a little bit ahead of that time. But she was sympathetic with those changes, and that's reflected in the music that she turned me on to and things like that. Umpire. In junior high, I stopped playing baseball, and although I would still go to baseball games sometimes, I didn't have the same enthusiasm for it that I did as a younger kid. I just didn't think it was as exciting as basketball and football and track. But I remember very starkly a story involving a baseball game, which has a larger social significance. Even in seventh grade, I was known to kids in my school, including older kids, as being really knowledgeable about sports. And one day there was a ninth grade baseball game between my junior high, Garfield, and Burbank Junior High, which was overwhelmingly black, with some Latinos. The Burbank team showed up for the game after school, all ready to play. But there was no umpire, so it looked like they would have to cancel the game. Some of the guys from the ninth grade Garfield team came up to me and said, "Hey, we want to play this game, but there's no umpire. Will you umpire the game?" And I foolishly said okay. So I was the only umpire. Usually, even in these junior high school games, you had at least two or three umpires. But I was all by myself. I had to stand behind the pitcher and call all the balls and strikes from there, and I had to cover all the bases, too. I stood behind the pitcher and called balls and strikes. Then the ball would be hit, and the runner would run toward first, and I had to go over there and say, "Safe!" or "Out!" Then if somebody was running the bases, I had to run around with them and say, "Safe!" or "Out!" Well, the game came down to the last inning, and the Garfield team was ahead by 2 runs. The Burbank team got 2 guys on base. The next Burbank batter came up, and was one of those dramatic moments. 2 outs, the last inning, and 2 guys on base for Burbank. The batter hit the ball to left field, way past the fielder, and these Burbank guys started running around the bases. One guy scored. Another guy scored. And then there was a question whether the guy who hit the ball was going to get all the way around to home. I'm running around the bases next to him. The Garfield outfielder finally catches up with the ball, throws it into an infielder, and the infielder then turns around and throws it to the catcher at home plate. The Burbank guy runs in and slides. There's this cloud of dust coming up from the dirt as he slides. The game is literally in the balance. I'm standing there, and there's a little delay. And everybody looks up at me. I yell, "Safe!" And all these guys from my school were furious at me. But I made the right call, because if you're in doubt or it's a tie, you're supposed to say "safe." And there was so much dust and everything that I couldn't really see, and it was really close. So I made the call that I thought was the honest call, which was "safe." But of course, all these kids in my junior high accused me of being intimidated by these guys from Burbank, and none of them would talk to me for a long time. Marcus Haynes style. I played basketball in the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades. We played Burbank and the other junior high school, Willard, which was about half black. These games were not only a lot of fun, but also formative experiences, especially given everything that was going on in the larger society. Schools in Berkeley, up through junior high, were still very segregated, as I've been describing. Usually, when we would go play Burbank, we'd go down there in a bus. Every year there would be a fight. Every year the kids from Garfield would run from the gym onto the bus to try to get away, and every year some of them would get their asses kicked trying to run away after the game at Burbank. It was like a ritual in an institution, and from the time you were in 7th grade, you knew this was going to happen. When I was in 8th grade, some friends of mine and their parents had taken me to see the Harlem Globetrotters. I was really taken with the Globetrotters, not so much all the comedy routines, but more this one player, I believe it was Marcus Haynes, who was a really great dribbler. He could dribble behind his back, in between his legs. He could lie on the floor and roll over and dribble the ball. And I just thought that this was unbelievably great. So I practiced and practiced and practiced, learning how to do these things. Then Burbank came up to play us at Garfield when I was in ninth grade. It was really close, going right down to the end of the game. There was less than a minute to go when we finally pulled ahead by about 8 points. I'd been practicing and practicing and practicing my dribbling and thinking about the Globetrotters. So when the game got down to about 40 seconds and we were just trying to hang on to the ball, I started dribbling, and all of a sudden I went down on one knee and then went on my back while still dribbling. And at first everybody thought it was just a mistake, like I'd fallen down. So I got up, dribbled around for a few more seconds, and then did it again. And then, of course, everybody knew I was doing it on purpose. At that point, the coach of our team called timeout. There were only about 30 seconds left in the game, but he took me out of the game and told this other guy, Randy, who was in the singing group I talked about, go in for Avakian. Randy says, I don't want to go in now. Go in for him now. So I come out and the coach takes me aside and says, we don't do that here. By that time, my eyes had been open enough that I knew exactly what he meant. I was being influenced by a lot of black culture. My best friend John was black, and I was becoming, as they say, sensitized to these things. So I knew exactly what the coach meant. I knew exactly what he was saying. And of course, that pissed me off all the more. But then, on the other hand, I took an I-don't-give-a-fuck attitude, because we'd won the game, and I got to do my thing. The irony was that I was doing this out of admiration for Marcus Haynes. I had modeled myself after him and his ability to dribble. It wasn't really that I wanted to show up the Burbank kids. It could have been anybody we were playing against. I just couldn't resist the chance to do this. The Burbank kids, of course, took it as an insult, and as an affront, and as a challenge. And that carried over to when we went down to the game in their gym. They had this one guy who assigned himself to guard me. His name was Langston Tabor, and he became a friend of mine in high school. But this was still our last year of junior high, and all the way down the court he would not only stick right with me, but he would push me and bump me. And three or four times in the first few minutes of the game was stopped because there were these shoving matches, and fights started to break out. Going into the game, a number of us had decided that we were not going to have this thing happen that had happened every year, where you'd be chased out of the gym. Now, that decision was a mixed bag. With some kids, there may have been some racism in it. But actually, for some of us, in a certain way, it was the opposite of that. We saw it as condescending and racist to run away. So it was all this mixed bag of different feelings. But anyway, they were angry at us not just because we'd beaten them in our gym, but because of what I'd done, because they took it as showing them up. And I guess there was a certain point they had, even though that wasn't my intention. So there was this very tense atmosphere. Finally, one of the officials from their school came down out of the stands and said, either you guys are going to play this game or you're not. The next fight that breaks out, I'm calling off the game. That's it. So then we proceeded to go through the rest of the game without a fight, but with a lot of tension. We ended up winning the game, and after the game, we didn't run, and there was no fight. First love. When I was 14, I started really getting interested in girls, and I had my first real girlfriend, Nancy. At that time, you didn't see this phenomenon that's interesting to observe now, where you have boys and girls just being friends and hanging around in a group together as friends. There was some of that, but not too much. Mainly it would take the form where sometimes, if you were interested in a girl, maybe you would actually develop a friendship with her friends, because if they liked you, they would help you get together. And so, on that level, you kind of become friends and share some intimate secrets about your feelings and things like that. But it didn't go much beyond that. Nancy and I really felt like we were in love. We went together for more than a year. My parents didn't like this so much. They felt I was spending way too much time with her. They may have had a point, but there was no way they were going to break us up. In fact, they tried to limit how much time I could spend with her, but I found ways to get around that. For example, Nancy lived about exactly a mile from my house, if you knew how to take shortcuts, which of course I did. So especially in the spring, summer, and early fall, when the weather was nice, and all the kids in my neighborhood would be out playing in the evening, I would tell my parents I was going out to hang out with the other kids, and then after a little while I would take off running the mile to my girlfriend's house. Then after a few hours at her house, I would run the mile back to my neighborhood and then go in my house. I got to where I could run that mile each way in 6 minutes. Teacher's trial. There was one thing I was really proud of in graduating from junior high. In our yearbook, besides things like favorite movie, favorite song, favorite food, etc., they also had categories like most likely to succeed, most popular, and so on. And I got voted teacher's trial, which meant the kid who gave the most trouble to the teachers. That was one of my proudest achievements and honors. So even though I had to make certain compromises and pull in my horn somewhat in the eighth grade to not get completely knocked down from things I wanted to do, I didn't strategically give in on my basic orientation of challenging authority, particularly where I felt it was unjustly or arbitrarily exercised. A lot of teachers regarded themselves as unchallengeable authority that had to be unquestioningly followed, and that just really rubbed me the wrong way. And to be honest, I took a lot of delight in finding ways to disrupt the classroom and challenge them. Ironically, I think a lot of my teachers actually liked me. But there was a lot of tension because I didn't like their exercise of arbitrary authority, and I enjoyed disrupting that. In my last year in junior high, I ran for election to this entertainment coordinator type post. You had to put up posters and things like that to get people to vote for you. I had a few friends who were helping me, but I also wanted to get some help from my family. So I asked my older sister if she would help me come up with some good slogans and make some posters, because she was pretty good at that kind of stuff. By this time, Marjorie was already married and had been out of the house and had a very young baby. But her husband was in the Navy. He was at sea somewhere. That poor guy used to come over to our house and he had to put up with a lot of my antics. For example, I'd get a hold of his sailor's hat and do magic tricks with it, which weren't really magic tricks at all, so he'd end up with orange soda in his hat and things like that. Anyway, they got married, and at this time she was living back in my parents' house. So Marjorie made a deal with me that she would help me come up with slogans and make posters if I would get up at night and feed her baby a couple of times during the week. It seemed like a good deal to me, but I found out it was harder work than I thought. But we did make that deal and carried it out, and she came up with a number of slogans. The one I remember the most was, "Don't be a crustacean, vote for a vacant." So I made posters with that slogan, and I put them up all over the halls of the junior high school. But although I won the election, the much bigger charge was when John and Randy and I, with our little group, were the big hit of the talent show that year.